Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and today my guest is author Stephen Ross Meyer. He is the author of the new book, Katka, a novella. So Stephen Meyer was born in Fort Sill, Oklahoma, the first of many places he would live worldwide. He received his bachelor's in English from Arizona State University, and he currently resides in Las Vegas, Nevada. Inspired by music, films, books, and the world around him, he is currently working on several projects with his next book, Teaching Pandas to Swim, ready to be released soon. A huge fan of such writers as Charles Bukowski, Milan Kundera, and Irving Welsh, Stephen has always been drawn to writing and storytelling. Having been diagnosed with heart disease in May of 2006, Stephen has been reminded that a life void of passion is really not a life at all. And you can find out more about Stephen and his books and his projects at StephenRossMeyer.com. So welcome to the program, Stephen.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me this morning.
Absolutely. Well, I want to congratulate you on publishing your first novel. It's always a great accomplishment.
Well, I appreciate that. Yes, it's something I've always wanted to do, and I couldn't be happier when I was finally able to hold it in my hands.
Yeah. Well, I understand that it actually started out as a screenplay.
Yes, it did.
Well, tell us, what was the start of this whole idea?
What started or inspired this whole idea is when I used to live in Prague, Czech Republic, it's going to date me, about 12 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
After college, I was traveling the world teaching English as a second language. And one of the days I was in Prague, I was waking up at the Hotel Intercontinental, coming downstairs from the elevator, and happened to walk into basically the wrong place. And I walked right into a mail order bride conference.
Oh.
And I was absolutely astonished at what I saw, and just amazed at how many beautiful women were willing to come over to the States and be people's wives, and you know, just to try to get that American passport. So. I always studied it, kind of looked into it, and just thought it'd make a great story.
Oh, I see. Okay. So you hadn't had any idea about how big the whole mail order bride business was up to that point? I mean, it's huge in Eastern Europe.
Oh, it's absolutely monstrous. Yeah, I mean, you always hear about it, and I guess that's it. You always hear about it, but you never really realize it until it smacks you in the face. And when you really start to look into it and study it, you realize it's a huge, huge enterprise. And that it doesn't just affect, you know, Eastern Europe or Asia or what have you, but it over here in the United States, so many people have purchased, I guess you could say, mail-order brides.
Right. So it's legal there. It's not legal here. But here in the U.S. and in the Western world, we're the biggest consumers.
Yes, exactly. It's very hypocritical. We frown upon it, but at the same time, we're the largest consumers of the brides themselves. So it's amazing there because, as I said, over there, it's just a business.
Right.
It's just another legitimate business, a way for people to make money and a way for some people to get out of maybe what's a bad situation, such as standing in line to get toilet paper in Moscow to come over to the United States.
So do they view it as being dangerous there? Because, I mean, typically what we hear on this side is that it can be a very dangerous business.
Yeah, I think that's where the line gets blurry between human trafficking,
mm-hmm.
Sex trade, and mail order brides. I think all three of those can get very blurred. Some of the very legitimate agencies that do mail order brides, they don't really see it as dangerous. As I said, they just see it as a business, and it's very professionally run.
Obviously, if they have conferences, yes, I've never heard of that.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say, is the conference. I had started talking to a few of the American guys that were there, and they were telling me how they joined this organization. This organization flew them over, took care of their hotels and expenses, and set this up in a very professional way. And you would think that just like, you know, living here in Vegas, the home of all the conventions, it was just similar to that, the way it was run. Very professional, name tags, you know, different hours and agendas on, okay, from this time to this time we're going to do this, from this time to this time. I was absolutely blown away by how professional it was.
So I'm really interested to hear what kind of research you did besides that first encounter to really prepare for this novel.
You know, truthfully, you know, a lot of people have asked me that. The only research I really did is besides that day, just really talking to a few people,
mm-hmm.
is I lived over in Europe for quite a while, so I would talk with girls. I would actually ask them questions about, do you know anyone that's done it? Would you do it? Why would you do it? And I was always amazed with the answers I would get. And other than that, that's really the only research I did. I mean, I would click online, and you could Google mail order brides, and so many of these sites pop up, and so many of them look, I guess, pretty trashy.
Mm.
But then you do come across the ones that look very organized. But for me, the story really is the emotional side of it, and just kind of it's more of a love story. So the research wasn't vast. It was nothing compared to someone like Arthur Golden for Memoirs of a Geisha or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Is there a main motivation in the talking that you did do with some of the girls? Is there a typical reason that they do it? Is it the opportunity for something better?
You know, that's what you come across a lot.
Yeah.
A lot of people still see America as the land of opportunity. And however they can get here and however they can get their hands on a passport is still really important to a lot of those people. Some of the situations that people live in over there are just things that I think a lot of us Americans just can't imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And how poor some of these families are. So for them, to marry someone that might have some money, and when I say some money, we can mean marry, you know, very moderate income, for them is huge. It's a huge difference.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, people always talk about how in Moscow that people stand in line to get toilet paper. Well, I mean, just imagine that right there.
Yeah.
That kind of living compared to coming over here. And even some of the poorest places.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I was always really moved by how people were willing to sacrifice. Maybe it wasn't just for themselves, but for their family in ways. Because you find that some of these people that purchase mail order brides also pay the families some kind of stipend or money as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that can, you know, $500 or $1,000 a month can go a long way in some of these places.
Oh, absolutely. So the whole family will benefit. How interesting.
Yeah.
Well, how long were you in Eastern Europe and in that area of Prague?
So what was that? How long was that?
How long, yeah, were you there?
I was in Eastern Europe. Well, I used to live in Germany, and we traveled throughout Germany and Europe when I was a younger kid.
Mm-hmm.
We did that for 2.5 years when my dad was stationed over in Germany. And when I graduated college, I moved over. In Eastern Europe, I would say 8 months
mm-hmm.
total. Most of that time I spent living in Prague.
I've heard great things about Prague.
Prague is, to me, the most beautiful city in the world. Like, architecturally, it's just amazing. You have the new with the old, and it looks like a fairy tale town. And I always tell people the thing that really blows me away about Prague is at night. It's almost like someone got up in a hot air balloon and decided, okay, we need lights here, here, and here, because this is how the city will look really beautiful at night.
Really?
I mean, it just looks like a little fairy tale town, and I just think it's absolutely gorgeous. I think the people were great. I think the culture themselves It's a great place.
Mm-hmm. I hear that there are more and more tourists that are going to Prague.
Oh, it's just overrun with tourists. I mean, most of the time in the summer, that's all you're going to run into is tourists. And there'll be times where you can, it takes you a good 35, 40 minutes to cross the Charles Bridge, which is, you know, what, at most 400 yards long?
Right. That's amazing. Well,
yeah.
So is it all over the world people are going to Prague, or is there one country in particular that is really, people are really attracted?
Well, obviously, I think, you know, the majority of Europeans always hit Prague up, but I think when I lived there, I heard a stat and a fact, and I'm not sure if this is true or not, but you would hear this quite a bit, that at the time I lived there, 30,000 Americans, expats, were living there.
Really?
At one time, yes.
Oh, my gosh, you would never think that. Well, how big is Prague? How many people?
No, I have no idea, to be honest with you, but I can say that there was a section of Prague where you felt like you were in America, but just with a really old buildings.
Oh, really?
Because there would be times where, you know, for example, if you were starting to miss getting homesick, I remember nights where we'd go and watch, like, Friends or shows like that at this bar, and it'd be just packed with Americans.
Isn't that something?
But at the same time, I would say from living over there and just and teaching that people from all over the world go there.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a, I mean, it's such a great city. It's such a beautiful city. It was a cheap city at the time when I lived there.
Mm-hmm.
You could live like a king for $500 a month.
Really?
And I think, you know, I remember it was 11 cents a beer when I was there.
I don't know if it's still like that.
No, I don't think it is because, you know, at the time when I was leaving, a lot of people were starting to refer to it as like the new Paris.
Yeah.
So I doubt it's that cheap. I'm pretty sure they caught on to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, so how much of Prague is really in this book and your experience that you had there?
You know, not a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot at all. I mean, the story could easily be placed in any Eastern European country, you know, whether it be Budapest or Krakow, any of those. I don't think, I mean, truthfully, the reason why I was based in Prague is just the fact that I lived there.
Mm-hmm.
And when we wrote it as a screenplay, I would envision scenes that would be shot in certain places of Prague, such as the Charles Bridge or the castle or what have you.
So clearly you are a writer that sees a vision and then you get it down on paper.
Oh, exactly. I mean, I see everything I write.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's how I write. Like, I just picture scenes and then I write about them and then I try to, at some point later, try to connect those scenes with other scenes that I've written.
Mm-hmm.
Someone just asked me about how I write. Like, do you always have, you know, the end of the story in mind? And I said, never. I mean, how could you? I think that would sway your mind one way or another while you write.
Mm-hmm.
To me, the writing is like a journey, as corny as that is, and wherever that takes you along the journey will change the story. So I just envision scenes, and I just try to write scenes. And then sometimes those scenes might not even fit that story.
Mm-hmm.
And they might fit another story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But,
it's a very organic, creative process when you write that way.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So it isn't particularly the characters that drive it for you or the plot. It's just everything together and a vision that you're seeing. You're a storyteller.
Yeah, and you know, truthfully, it really starts also with a dialogue. I think my biggest strength as a writer is just my dialogue, because in CAC itself, it's really a dialogue-driven piece. It's a very quick read because it's almost all dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously that makes sense because it was a screenplay.
Do you prefer to write for the screen?
That was always my goal.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a goal in the way that I wrote CACA and the way that I published CACA myself and went about it was to write for the screen. I've always been in love with books and writing, but at the same time, I'm one of those people who see the difference between a good writer and a good storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I ever would put myself as a great writer, but a good storyteller.
Mm-hmm. Well, I read in your bio, you're inspired by films and music and books also. So it sounds like, you know, this niche of screenplay is really your place. So where are you going to be going with CATCA, with this project? Or will you try to get it to screen?
Well, I'm glad you asked that.
Yeah.
Because I'm actually going to be moving to Budapest, Hungary, first part of July, as a company, Digital Slave Productions, has decided to make this a movie.
Really?
Yes. So that's why I said there was a reason why I went about doing this. So my goal hopefully will soon be realized. We've been in negotiations for past, I would say, 3 to 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
We've hammered out a budget. we've hammered out a timeline. We have a director, two directors that are assigned to the project now, and their only concern was, did I care if the story took place in Budapest opposed to Prague? So when you ask that question about how much does Prague play a part, it doesn't really, as much as just any Eastern European city could. And Budapest is like a sister city of Prague. They're very similar. Very similar. They're laid out almost exactly the same, with the Vltava River coming through Prague, whereas in Budapest, it's the Danube. Both have castles on the hill. Both have big, beautiful bridges that are famous.
Mm-hmm.
So they're very similar. And after I told them no, I think Budapest is equally as gorgeous. We decided to move forward with that. So hopefully we'll begin casting for the American parts in L.A. next month here in June. And then we'll be casting for all the female parts, which are all Eastern European actresses. We will actually use Eastern European actresses.
Oh, that's great. Well, how exciting.
Yeah, I'm very excited. It's been really hard to sleep for the past 4 weeks.
Oh, my gosh, I bet it is. So yeah. All other projects at this point are on hold for you?
No, not at all, actually. Mm-hmm. There's another story that I'm just really been hammering at called Suicide Blonde.
Mm-hmm.
And so I still try to work on that. Granted, there's a lot of time that does get dedicated to moving forward with the movie. This story I'm really attached to as well, so I can't help but, knock out some lines here and there.
Yeah, you definitely are a creative person. Well, why don't you tell our audience a little bit about the novel, the characters you have in it. We've been talking about it, but let's get right down to it and tell our audience about your book.
Okay. Well, it's called Kaka. It's a novella. Obviously, it's a novella because it's only 108 pages in length, very short, very quick read. And the reason I wrote it that way is I had this opinion, and I could be wrong, but every time I ask my friends what's the last book they read, they have no idea. So I feel like as Americans, we don't read as much anymore.
We don't.
And especially adults. I mean, I think our younger generation reads, obviously, with the sales of Twilight and Harry Potter. Someone's reading those. So I wanted it to be something quick, something someone could pick up and just get attached to and realize, wow, this is really quick. I'll just read one more chapter. And then they read it and they realize, wow, I really want to find out what happened. So most of the people who have read my book have said, I've read it in one sitting or what have you. But the story itself is a love story, and it takes place in Prague, Czech Republic. And it's, in essence, about sort of a young American man, Gavin, who is kind of escaping something from America and getting away from things and falls in love with a beautiful Czech girl named Kaka, and who ends up getting him involved in the mail-order bride business. And originally it starts as a scam. And unfortunately, things kind of go wrong, and next thing you know, Gavin is thrown smack in the world of mail-order brides. And he's mixed up with Kaka's best friend, Simona, who is basically the devil reincarnated, but a beautiful one. And he finds that he's living the life of the mail-order bride business, but at the same time realizing that he just sold his very own girlfriend and the girl of his dreams. And the whole story takes place around that. It starts basically right in the middle from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people told me when they pick it up, they're like, wow, you don't waste any time.
Mm-hmm.
It just starts like a fire. And the story is just basically how he laments his life as he made a huge mistake. And what can he do to change it? And can he fix it? Or can it ever be fixed?
Mm-hmm.
And then it really starts to ask the question, love versus greed, what's more important? At the same time, at the end, you wonder who is scamming who. So there's a lot of twists, a lot of craziness that goes on in the book. And some people are, when they finish reading the book, are really unhappy with the ending because they want more.
It's a little ambiguous.
Yes, mm-hmm. and I did it on purpose. It's another way that I write. Like, I'm one of those writers that doesn't want to tell the reader everything.
Mm-hmm.
I want the reader to have some of their own imagination. And that's what I really enjoy getting feedback from people is the way they view certain scenes, characters, motives, what have you, the ending that they see, the ending they want to see, or what have. So, that's basically it. There's three main characters,
mm-hmm.
and two beautiful Eastern European girls and one American who just made a big mistake.
Made a big mistake. So it's not necessarily the romantic novel with a happy ending.
No,
yeah.
It is not Pretty Woman.
Right.
And, that's it's funny you say that because I got in an argument. I was signed with an agent 10 years ago with Litopia Agency out of London.
Mm-hmm.
I won't mention his name, but. Anyways, he was more, when the first novel I wrote, he was really pushing for that Hollywood happy ending, and it really just bugged me because I don't think that happens in everyday life. But it's the same way, as you mentioned, the ending is ambiguous, so maybe there is. Maybe it is a happy ending for some.
Well,
depends how you read it and how people want to see it.
Right, and yeah, exactly.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Hi there. Are you looking for new ways to promote your book? Why not consider being interviewed live? With the huge impact internet radio as well as podcasting is making in our society, your voice can now be heard worldwide. Let Juanita at Inside Scoop Live create the necessary steps for you. You will not only receive a web page of your own, but your interview will be available for MP3 download and RSS feed. As well, your interview will be posted on venues such as iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, Podcast Alley, and the Inside Scoop Live blog. Go to InsideScoopLive.com today for more information. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Just to remind you, I'm talking today with Stephen Ross Meyer. He is the author of Katka, a novella, and you can find out more about Stephen through his website, StephenRossMeyer.com. Well, you also approach the theme of can things be unsaid or undone? Mm-hmm. And so tell us a little why you wanted to explore that in this book.
You know, I think that's something you see every day, whether it's on the news, in books and movies. I think of, you know, like The Joke by Milan Kundera, or The Idiot by Dostoevsky, and things that people have done, and whether it was done on purpose or not, in a joking manner, maybe a bad decision. You know, can things be can I'm sorry, clear everything up? Can people forgive and forget? Can you unsee what you've seen? Can things that have been said be unsaid? I think it's a really important thing to question because you hear people talk about it all the time. And for me, I think that there's a lot of personalities that you can't do that. And I think it's a really strong emotion and a strong feeling. And even, you know, as much as someone might love someone, sometimes maybe you need to love yourself more. And to do that, you have to make some seriously drastic decisions that you're always going to live with.
Mm.
And I think that happens in this book. There's a couple of decisions people make. And you wonder, as I think as a reader, you question why or what was the motive behind that. And then people ask themselves, well, what would I do in this situation?
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of like the way I wanted to leave the ending as well, is what would you do as a reader? Could you move on with what you've seen or what someone said to you?
Well, it sounds like you've really contemplated the whole idea of love, and I'm wondering how much of your own experience went into this and really what your ideas are of commitment and sacrifice.
Wow, that's a big question.
Huh? Sure.
I'm going to have to tell my mom about this one later. What are my ideas? Well, I think, you know, I think anyone that's a writer in a way is kind of a hopeless romantic. I believe in love. I think I believe in the fairy tale, but as every year passes, more and more things you've seen, I start to question it. I do think that you can be utterly, absolutely in love with someone and that you can be with someone. And at the same time, I just wonder, you know, are we meant to just love one person for the rest of our lives? I think the older I get and the more you see it now, especially because I live in Las Vegas, which, I mean, that's a whole nother conversation.
Oh, boy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. How long have you been there?
I've been here too long.
Okay.
Yeah, so I do believe in it.
That's okay. That's enough.
Yeah, I'm trying to think what else to say. I do believe in love, but at the same time, I believe if you love someone truly, you know, decisions you make, the things, you know, like going back to the earlier question, some things happen that I don't, you have to love yourself, I think, more sometimes.
So it's not the fairy tale. You don't believe in the fairy tale.
I do and I don't.
Yeah, interesting.
I mean, I do, but in a weird way.
Yeah.
I believe in the fairy tale like a snow globe, right? Snow globe is a beautiful little piece of art, right? But isn't the snow globe more beautiful when you shake it up?
Yeah.
So that's kind of the way I look at it.
That's great. I'm really interested to hear how your diagnosis in 2006 with the heart disease, how that has really changed your writing or your desire for writing and the direction your life is going in now?
That's a great question. And that's a great thing that happened, as messed up as that is. When that happened to me on May 10th, 2006, which is you know, wow, we're coming on a little anniversary here.
Mm-hmm,
I didn't even realize that until you just said that.
Yeah.
That's weird. I was shocked because I wasn't the typical person to be diagnosed. Obviously, I was 32 years old, very young. I was in great shape. I don't smoke. I don't drink excessively. I watch what I eat. I've been always very healthy with growing up with sports. So it was an absolute shock. Something just came out of right field and that happened. And to have these operations and have stents put in your heart and not really know what that is, and then, you know, you go online and, you know, it's one of those debates, is the internet a good thing or a bad thing? Because if you go online and you read these WebMD things, you're just going to put yourself in a tizzy.
Mm-hmm.
It really woke me up because I'd walked away from writing for a long time because I got really burned in Hollywood 7 years ago. Just realized that Hollywood's one of those places someone will say something to your face, make a deal with you, turn around, and you'll never hear from them again.
Ugh.
And it just really, really enraged me, and I moved to Vegas from L.A.
Mm-hmm.
And I got involved in a business where I knew I could make some money, but I felt like I sold my soul, where I was making really good money, but I was not happy, you know. From the outside, I was probably one of those people that people are like, wow, look at him, got all this, he must be, you know,
successful.
So successful. And then you realize you're home every night watching movies being like, wow, I really don't want to go to work tomorrow.
Yeah.
Like I felt like I should have gotten an Academy Award for every performance I put in every day.
Wow.
So when that happened, and you're laying there, and for me it happened so quick that I wasn't able to have anyone there. It wasn't like this planned surgery. Hello?
Yeah, sorry. Okay. Yeah, that was weird. We'll edit that out.
I actually valeted my car. Because, you know, we have valet in Vegas. I ran upstairs, and next thing I know, 3 days later, I'm being released. So
wow.
I wasn't even able to have my family there or anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was told the news, I was just in absolute shock. And then having the surgery and laying there and having people tell you, oh, you're too young, you're too young. I mean, they've got to train some of these nurses and doctors not to say things like that.
Yeah,
that
that's just very traumatic.
It was. Like,
oh, my God.
You just don't need to hear it. And I honestly think I heard that 1,000 times. And matter of fact, I can go so far as to say when after the surgery, they wheel me up to the heart ward for intensive care after the surgery. The nurses were like, oh, you must have the wrong floor. He's way too young. And the guys wheeling me up were like, no, he just had, you know, surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And you just sit there going, wow, this is not helping.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm in this ward with everyone that's probably over the age of 65 or 70.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And here I am.
Terrified.
So, yeah, terrified, and you sit there, and you're all alone thinking about this, and you really start to reevaluate your life, and you realize, as much as you hear people say that tomorrow's not promised for everyone, it really hits you,
mm-hmm.
and it makes you decide, well, how am I going to live the rest of my life? You know, there's that famous Greek line, every time someone in Greece dies, they ask, did he live his life with passion?
Yeah.
And I realized I wasn't doing that at all.
Mm-hmm.
I'd sold out and walked away from the thing I loved the most, and it was time to make those changes.
And go get back to it.
Yeah, so I decided to sell my business and put everything I had into what I'm passionate about, which is writing. And I've been working very hard on this and other projects and out there trying to market myself and talk to the right people. I mean, I've been to almost every film fest in the last 4 months just trying to talk to people, get my name out there, give away free books. I've given away so many free books, you know, I'm probably broke.
Yeah, but it's paying off if you're getting movie deals. I mean,
exactly.
Look at that.
And that's the way I look at it is, you know, I knew it would work because I just knew that. And when I knew it was going to work, one of the best moments I had is just, you know, when people review it. And you have friends review your book and they tell you, oh, it's great. But then I remember one day I clicked on Amazon and was looking at some reviews. And just random people, I had no idea who these people were. And just some of the things they said about my book, I was just blown away.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, you almost sit there crying and go, wow, look at this. Someone said this. Mm. Or I saw when some girl on Facebook wrote, she changed her favorite book to Cacti by Stephen Meyer.
Mm.
I was like, that's amazing. I have no idea who this person is.
Oh, how validating.
It really is. And I just remember thinking, you know, it's all worth it. And I just think that maybe it's easier said than done for some people. It's different situations. But if you don't really follow what you truly desire, I feel like, in a way, that's why I was diagnosed with heart disease.
Yeah.
In some strange way, it was God telling me, you know what, you've loved this for so long.
Yeah.
And you're not doing it.
Yeah. You were heartbroken.
I was, and I feel like now, and ever since I sold my business and been writing, my cardiologist is like, you're in the best you've ever been.
Mm.
We have no problems. I'm finally off of every heart drug I was on.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel great. You know, I feel great now.
That is so wonderful. So are you able at this point to align yourself with people in the industry, both in the movie industry and the literary world, that are really incongruent with where you're going in your direction, so it's not like the L.A. budget you were dealing with before?
I would say the movie world I'm getting more aligned with. The literary world still hasn't come knocking.
Uh-huh.
But at the same time, I haven't been knocking down their doors.
Yeah.
At all. Because I think I've always wanted more of the movie. Because as I said, I think that's where my strength lies, is in dialogue. So obviously I can either write plays or I can write screenplays.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I'm obsessed with watching movies. Like my DVD collection, it probably, you know, outdoes Blockbuster.
Really? Well, clearly that's where you're putting your energy, so that's where it's coming back to.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So that's another thing that I feel like there's a validation is, see, there's a reason why I have all these movies.
Yeah, right. So who are some of your favorites? So who inspires you?
Well, screenplay-wise, I think Quentin Tarantino is just obviously an amazing writer. Well, I should maybe change that and say maybe he was an amazing screenwriter.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's kind of gone off the deep end a little bit.
He's changed quite a bit, hasn't he?
Yeah, but I mean, you look at some of his original works like Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah.
Or really, to me, my favorite screenplay of all time is True Romance.
Mm.
I just think it's just one of the wittiest, you know, greatest screenplays written.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then obviously Pulp Fiction. Then obviously Woody Allen. I mean, the guy, you know, just watching Vicky Cristina Barcelona this past weekend.
Yeah.
Just he's an amazing writer.
Yeah, he is. Yeah.
So those are two of the biggest screenwriters that I would say I really, really love. As far as writers in general, obviously, like my website says, I think Charles Bukowski makes the everyday life just really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always really enjoyed him. Milan Kundera, I've always thought is an amazing writer, just as a writer himself.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the people. And then Bret Easton Ellis, actually. Bret Easton Ellis, you know, in some circles, is people are like, wow, ever since he wrote American Psycho, I think he scared off a lot of people. But I think he's a brilliant writer as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So.
I bet you don't have much free time. Sounds like you're very busy.
I try to stay very busy. I mean, I guess sometimes a lot of my free time is, I mean, one of the greatest things I do every morning besides write is I'll probably get started up and write at 7 in the morning. And I always write at Starbucks. I never write at home.
Mm-hmm.
I always need to have kind of a little bit of chaos around me,
mm-hmm.
like music going, people walking around. But then I always say I have a lot of friends up here that come up to the Starbucks about 9 o'clock and just having conversations with them. Because as I said, a lot of stories will get started from a dialogue, so a story that I've heard or something, a line someone has said, and then my mind just starts running in directions with that.
Right, right. And then what, do you go home and write, or is it just?
You know, sometimes I say, guys, I got to put my headphones back on and hammer this out.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Go home. Or, you know, I think a lot when I go running of lines and stuff. And I always, you know, carry my iPhone because obviously that's my iTunes on it, but it also has that little notepad. Like, I'll stop in the middle of a run and write down a line that I've remembered or something.
So you just mentioned an iPod. So what music are you listening to these days?
Oh, wow. Well,
because clearly that's going to be, you know, in your work too.
Yeah, it is. Let's see. I would say the music that really drives this when I was writing is, like, I think Radiohead.
Mm-hmm.
That's fantastic. I think that Catherine Wheel, an old man.
Oh, really, yeah, good. I remember Catherine
Yeah.
Wheel.
There's one of those bands that when you say that, people are like, wow, wait a minute, that's right.
Yeah.
Kings of Leon, I think his new album is amazing. The Tragically Hip. You know, they're like the Rolling Stones of Canada.
You're talking to a Canadian. I know who
they are
very well.
Oh, there you go. I just think they're amazing.
Yeah, they are.
First of all, they've got just great music, but I'm always a big fan of singers and songwriters who tell stories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of like Counting Crows and Adam Duritz. That guy's just a poet.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel the same way about Tragically Hip.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, there's people like Lenny Kravitz, too, where my first novel I wrote, or the novel that I want to put out, again, is Teaching Paths to Swim. There's so many scenes in that that are inspired by his songs, Lenny Kravitz.
Really?
Yeah, there's so many songs that match up almost right on for the chapters. Yeah, so, I mean, I can remember writing so many of those scenes, and I can hear it now in my back of my head, so many of his songs.
That is so interesting.
So, it's funny, because when I want to write something like a love scene, or if I want to write, like, a sad scene or what have you, I have different songs that I'll click on to do that.
Really?
Yeah.
And it gets you in that state.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Well, music is powerful.
Oh, I think it's very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just absolutely have to have it. Like, what's funny is one of the songs I always listen to right when I begin my day to write is Mother Love Bone's Crown of Thorns.
Oh.
Like, I don't know what it is.
Uh-huh.
It's a whole song that I kind of need to listen to.
That
and
is great.
Jump right into it.
And you're not getting sick of it yet?
No, amazingly
yeah.
not. Like, I will kill a song. Like, I will.
Yeah.
Like, right now, I have this new song, right? It's called Kids by MGMT. I don't know if you've heard it.
No, I haven't. Mm-mm.
Oh, my God. It's like this upbeat kind of club song, like European club song. And I don't know what it is, but I think this morning alone, I probably listened to it 100 times. And I will still, as soon as we get off the phone, I'll jam that back on.
You're going to put it back on. So, clearly, you have an idea of soundtracks with.
Oh, I definitely do.
Yeah.
I definitely do. I mean, yesterday, actually, last night, I was talking to a friend of mine who has become a friend since Sundance Film Festival. I met him on the streets of Sundance Film Festival. I love this kid. He was sitting there with his guitar, CDs out on a blanket, and he was just playing acoustic guitar. Just beautiful voice, beautiful guitar arrangement. Just, I mean, great songs.
Mm-hmm.
And he was up there just trying to get his music up.
Mm-hmm.
Him and I swapped a book for a CD, listened to his CD. I listened to his CD the entire drive home from Salt Lake or from, you know, Park City to Vegas, which is about a five and a half hour drive. Never took his CD out of my car.
Wow.
And I have decided that his song is also the song that plays on my website as well as the video for my book.
Mm-hmm.
I think his music is so strong that I've asked him to write a few songs for the movie.
What's his name?
Well, his name of his band is Heart Pharmacy.
Heart Pharmacy, okay.
And I really encourage everyone to go out and listen to this kid. I really think one day he's just going to blow up and people are going to be like, wow. I mean, he's like a young prince. He does everything on his own.
Really?
And he plays all the different instruments, and it's amazing. Because if you listen to the two songs, just the difference between the song on my website versus the song on the video.
And the video, I've heard. I would have never guessed that was
the
same. Yeah,
you would never guess that's the
mm-hmm,
same version.
Mm-hmm.
And then he has another one on heartpharmacy.net that he started writing. It's another instrumental that he's actually writing that song for Kaka right now.
Mm.
So you just would never guess this kid's the same kid.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think he writes beautiful stuff, and, you know, he's an up-and-comer, and I really want to get him involved. And that's kind of the idea behind the movie, too, is everyone always asks me, well, who do you see playing this and that?
Yeah.
I don't want known people.
Right.
We're actually going to use known people as far as Eastern Europeans, but no American knows them. But I really think it's a great launching pad for some people's careers here.
I think it's fantastic. We have seen the same people playing over and over again to nauseam.
It really is. And I really think that, you know, I want to make a movie that's, you know, so visually stunning. Like, obviously, it's filled with beautiful people, beautiful wardrobe on the backdrop of Budapest, which in itself is just an artistic city
mm-hmm.
with great music, great dialogue, and just really kind of heart-thumping, kind of riveting storyline.
Mm-hmm.
So
I've heard rumors of sequel.
You know, it's funny. I never even thought about that, right? When I finished the book, I finished the book.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know how many reviews have mentioned that and how many friends have hammered me at Starbucks and they come walking in after reading going, okay, what the hell? Give me a sequel? Are you writing a sequel? Or I'll get Facebook messages from people. Are you going to write a sequel? You have to write a sequel. I had one guy that I've become friends with in Pennsylvania who was like, I got some ideas for your first sequel.
Oh, that's funny.
And I was like, okay, what do you got? And he, you know, gave him my phone number, he called me. I was like, wow, that's really interesting, actually.
Hmm.
So, I mean, I've kind of played around with it. I've written some ideas. But right now I'm my head's so into the story Suicide Blonde.
Yeah.
As well as another story, actually, I'm writing called 4 Days in November.
Mm-hmm.
That I kind of just separated that.
Oh, okay.
But
you have a lot of projects on the go.
Well, I think my mind just never stops.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of, as we discussed before, when you read a review or you get when I get a note from someone and they give you such high praise, it just makes you want to write more and more.
Oh, yeah.
It just validates.
Just fuels the fire.
Yeah, I got a review from another author. Her name is Geraldine Ahern, Jerry Ahern. She's written 6 books. And she gave me this just amazing review. I mean, just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And to have another person that's been in the trenches writing and has written as many books as she has, to say the words she said it just really makes you want to just keep trying to write as much as you can.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, we're going to be hearing from you for years.
Years. I hope so. I hope so.
Well, we need to mention your website again. It's stephenrossmeyer.com, and your book can be bought through your website,
mm-hmm.
and music is there, and other information about you and your upcoming projects.
Uh-huh.
All of that's up there.
And also, when we start the whole movie, what we're going to do is we're going to have updates on the website.
Oh, okay, great.
As far as kind of like little video footage of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like people to see the behind the scenes.
Oh, that's great. Well, you have a blog.
I do.
You'll be adding to that?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Yes. So we'll keep up with. Are you on Twitter and all of that?
You know, I think I'm on Twitter. I don't tweet.
Yeah.
Maybe I should start. You know, on Facebook, I'm probably the most. I try to be really good about getting to anyone, and especially if they want to talk about it and discuss it. So, and I'm on MySpace. I don't really check that much, but I try to be really open and accessible to people.
That's great. You have to be. You have to be networking that way.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Yeah, as a writer, for sure. Well, Stephen, this has been a great conversation. It's gone by so quick. I'm going to have to let you go.
Okay.
But really, all the best to you.
I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it sounds like you are just on the way to really, really big things. And I'm just so happy to have had the chance to talk with you right before it all launches.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
You bet. You take care.
All right, thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Okay, audience, that's Stephen Ross Meyer. His new book, Katka, a Novella, is out now. And do go to his website, StephenRossMeyer.com, for all sorts of information. You can purchase the book there, but as mentioned, he's going to be adding all sorts of info and videos about his up-and-coming project in Budapest. So do check it out. Well, I want to thank you for tuning in to Inside Scoop Live once again. I'm Juanita Watson, and until next time.